Hello everyone and welcome to today's episode of the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio, your feel-good radio. I'm your host Yasmin. I am a writer, a journalist. I write about the natural world and part of my research this month is in Cyprus, where I am partaking in a very exciting opportunity to learn about the forest of Cyprus. So today we were deep into the olive groves and understanding the ancient tradition and culture that have kept alive these ancient olives for many, many years, and only recently have been in danger because the new generation has left the village, as they have in many places from around the world, and it eventually means that these olive trees are no longer cared for and in a way that they used to be, and are left open to disease and poorly treated and maintained. So what I understand is that the Cypriot government has now intervened and is looking after these olive groves that were once looked after by the community. And over the coming month, I'm really excited to be sharing more with you about my journey here in Cyprus with a wonderful group called Guardians of the Forest, brought together nations of people and of forest guardians, including indigenous leaders from all across the world, to create more of a holistic understanding of ecology. So thank you all who are currently tuning in at the moment. It's really exciting to be here and to have you with me sharing my journey. So I will be updating you and filling you in as I'm here. Cyprus is a very beautiful country and there's lots to learn about the forests. They've currently been experiencing lots of forest fires, so we've been learning about their prevention mechanisms and what that means for the forests in both a good and a bad way, and what can be done to prevent forest fires. So please do stay tuned over the next few months and I will be sharing all about my journey here in Cyprus. In today's show, however, we will be exploring the concept of rewilding in particular. So what exactly is rewilding? So rewilding is a form of conservation that's aimed at restoring and protecting the natural processes of wilderness areas. So this kind of includes connecting between such areas and protecting or reintroducing apex predators and keystone species that were once seen in a particular landscape but have been taken away by reintroducing particular species, for example, the wolf in the United States or the beaver or even birds of prey, for example, in Scotland. Farmers, people who manage landscape, are often opposed to this method as it can threaten their livestock. And today we have two special guests on the show who will be giving us some insight into rewilding and wild spaces. We have Andrei Laletin, who is from Russia, who will be exploring the Siberian tribal indigenous way of looking after forests, as well as rewilding and the drawbacks. And then we will go to a more practical interview with Chloe, who is someone who is currently working on rewilding her own piece of land. Hello, I'm here with Andrei Laletin, who is joining me here on a Forest Guardian Cyprus trip where we're discovering the ancient forests and folklore here in Cyprus. Audrey has been working with forests in Siberia and is joining us all the way from Russia. Hi Audrey, and thank you for joining us on the show today.
Hello Yasmin. I am co-chairman of Friends of the Earth Russia, Russian Social Ecological Union. Also, I am membership coordinator for the Global Forest Coalition. I coordinate NGOs in Eastern Europe and Central Asia for Global Forest Coalition, and also I coordinate program of extractive industries, tourism, and infrastructure for Global Forest Coalition.
Wow, you're doing a lot with the forest over in Siberia. What area are you currently working in within the forest, and what do you do in order to help protect and preserve the beautiful forest of Siberia?
Yeah, I work on forest issues since 1980s, when I was a student of Krasnoyarsk State University. I did my PhD on forest ecology in Siberian forests, and since then I was professor of Krasnoyarsk State University and also Siberian Technological University, and I studied a lot in forests in Siberia, in Mongolia, in Belarus, and it is my destiny, I think.
Yes, and you're currently participating in this course. What led you to work with Forest Guardians, and what was it that you learned from this course, and how is it that you're bringing forward information from this course into your own work?
Director of Forest Guardians invited me to give a presentation, and I did it in 2nd of June about traditional forest-related knowledge of Siberian tribes. And it was really interesting also to listen other lectures or presentations from other teachers of Forest Guardians course. And it's really interesting to meet students here in Cyprus and communicate and speak about forests of different parts of the world.
Amazing. And you said you were learning and teaching about Siberian traditional knowledge about keeping the forests. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, we work with shamans of several tribes of Buryat, Tuvin people, Keto, and it is really interesting to get this ancient knowledge. Many modern people don't know about this, and it is really very important to keep this knowledge, conserve it, and transfer to next generations.
Mm. And what is it about the tribal shamans that they have to say about the forest? What kind of knowledge is it that they're trying to pass on to us and to the future generations?
They say that people are not different from other animals, that we need to live in harmony in forest, don't take more than need. When traditional indigenous hunters go, for example, first they pray and they ask mercy for animals that they need to kill for survival of their tribe. If they need to cut a tree, for example, they also pray and ask mercy of that tree, that they need to build a house for, and if they want to fish, for example, they also ask permission. And they never take more than they need. It is not in their custom to sell something what they take from the forest. They take only as little as necessary for their survival. Now many of these tribes go to cities, especially young people, and they lose these traditions, knowledge, and it is really very important to speak to people who knows how to live in harmony with forest and distribute this knowledge widely.
That's really fascinating, especially because on this show in particular, we're looking at wild forests, and in many parts of the UK and Scotland and in America as well, we're trying to keep the forests wild. And part of this is a form of conservation where we kind of keep people out and send and reintroduce different species to the forest. But from the shaman's perspective, it seems like there is a way to live in coexistence with the forest.
Yes, it is important to live in harmony with forests, and also there are two ways of conservation. One is conservation by local people, and it works in many parts of the world. Local people protect forests with totems, with taboo, and with other forms of traditional knowledge. And there is another one, mostly scientific part, to keep out people from the forest and leave forest without people. So from social point of view, it is not human to take people out of the forest, but there are many places in Siberia where we don't have people at all, and there is system of so-called zapovedniki. It is Russian word for nature reserves, and there are more than 100 nature reserves in Russia, and this system is for more than 100 years already in Russia. It is similar to system of national parks in the US, but in the US very often they have commercial part. And unfortunately, Russian government decided also to make many nature reserves into national parks to get profit. It is not good for nature. Maybe it's good from economic point of view. But this place, for example, in Barguzin, in Lake Baikal, was without people for more than 100 years, and now to allow people to come there, it would be more disturbance, and and many of my colleagues don't like this new trend making wild forests with people and with tourism.
Definitely, it seems like when there's more of an economic standpoint in conservationism, that's when it doesn't seem to work, especially. And what do you think about in certain parts of the world where they reintroduce certain species in order to create or try and replicate an ecosystem that used to be there, for example, in America where they introduced wolves, or in certain parts of the UK they've started reintroducing beavers, and they're even thinking about reintroducing the lynx. Some people say it works and some people say no, because the ecosystem's already changed.
It depends if we introduce animals that were in that place before. We need to follow scientific rules, scientific laws of natural successions. With trees and plants, it is even more difficult, because very often there are no seeds of these trees or plants. And in Siberia, for example, after disturbance, after logging, after forest fires, we don't get ecosystem of so-called taiga forest, that is boreal forest of Siberia, for 400 years. First, after logging or after fire, there would be stage of pioneer trees, of birch, of aspen. This stage would be for about 60, 80 years, and then only under cover of these deciduous trees there will be young coniferous trees, fir, spruce, larch, and it takes for more than 200, 300 more years when these trees become mature, and when ecosystem will go closer to climax stage.
Okay. So in certain parts of the world, it wouldn't work if you just reintroduced a certain animal?
It's necessary to know, for example, wolverine. It is an animal that needs lots of wild territories, at least 100 square kilometers. If there are small patches of forest, it's not possible to introduce it. For lynx, also we need smaller patches, but still we need natural forest. We need animals that lynx would eat. For wolves, it is even more difficult because there can be conflict with local farmers, local rural people, and it's necessary to compensate them for all cows or sheep that wolves will eat. So it's not easy question, and so in every place it's necessary to negotiate with local people first and ask their permissions, then test it, and in some places it may work, in some places it may not work.
Have you worked much in the boreal forest?
Yes, I worked all my life in boreal forest, and mostly in Siberia, but also in some places in Alaska, in British Columbia. I visited some places in Scandinavia, in Finland, in Sweden. Unfortunately, in Europe, we don't have much natural boreal forests left. So it is necessary to protect remainings of natural boreal forests, both in Scandinavia, in Canada, Alaska, and in Siberia.
Can you please explain to listeners who don't know what a boreal forest is, what constitutes as an ecosystem for
a boreal forest? Boreal forests are forests from coniferous trees, from fir, spruce, pine. Then there is natural succession from them. After logging or after fire, I told that it can be succession from deciduous trees, but sometimes in wet places, in where are boggy swampy places, we can never get these coniferous forests back, because bogs will occupy this territory, and there will be no germination of seeds of these trees, and we shall get these swamps for many future generations. So it's necessary to help forest. First, with climate change, we have more and more forest fires, more and more outbreaks of pests, history, boreal forests have these dynamics of fires or of pests, but not so often like now. Every 300, 400 years there were huge forest fires, and then big territories burned, and then place by place there were different stages of natural successions. So forests were uneven aged, but unfortunately People are very greedy and want to have these coniferous forests soon, so they try to avoid stage of birch and aspen, and they plant fir, spruce, or Siberian pine that we call Siberian cedar. But in Siberia, for example, there is no money and not enough labor to take care of these seedlings. And in 10 years, in 15 years, 20 years, they either burnt or will be substituted either by bushes or by grass or by swamp. Or by deciduous forest. So it is not economical to jump through these stages, but unfortunately in many places in Siberia it is kind of regulation that after logging you need to plant the same trees that were cut, but it is not successful in most of cases.
Have you seen any successful examples of people working with the forest, like communities that look after the forest but also are interact with it in a way that's not just for maybe for their livelihood but not purely for economics?
Yes. I would say that all indigenous people have a really successful way of getting with forest. They don't have clear cuts because in Siberia main way of logging is clear cutting of big squares of 100 hectares and it's not sustainable from all points of view, only of short economic term. These indigenous people, they hunt only of one bear, for example, or one moose, and it's enough for them for several days, for example. If they fish, for example, they fish only a little bit. So, and these tribes, they lived for millennia in harmony with nature, but industrial forestry or industrial agriculture, it is really very harmful for nature. And mining is also very harmful. There are lots of oil, gas, gold, diamonds, everything in Siberia, but companies, multinationals mostly, they try to get as much as possible from the forests, and they pollute land with oil, they make big holes and when they get ore of different minerals, for example, and it is really very harmful for the nature.
Okay, thank you, Audrey, so much for joining us on the Environment and Conservation Show today. Is there anything you would like to add on this subject?
Yeah, I would like to say that people should study more cases from our nature resource management or forest management, and indigenous people, they can teach us how people should deal with forestry, with conservation. And also it is important to collect their knowledge and preserve them and distribute it, because especially with climate change, this knowledge can be very valuable for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Joining us today on the show is Chloe, who is the daughter of a chicken farmer who, along with her siblings, has inherited the land from her father and wants to make it more sustainable. And in order to do so, she's introducing more plants and species that are native to the UK. And I met Chloe whilst participating on a tree planting project on her land that she'd organised in order for the community to get together and help them plant these trees on the land. Chloe is kind of linking between the human therapeutic aspects of being in nature with rewilding. Whilst rewilding for some can be seen as simply leaving an environment to do its thing, by actively participating in rewilding, Chloe sees community organization and participation as a key element in her rewilding project.
So I am here in the beautiful fields of Hertfordshire, planting trees on some land with a lovely lady called Chloe. Hello, Chloe.
Hello.
Hi. And welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show. So as we're just sat here in the sun, can you please introduce yourself and you to bring people onto your land to plant trees?
Yeah, sure. I'm Chloe, and this is a piece of land here in Hertfordshire that I've been connected to through my family for 30 years, which from a family human perspective feels like a long time, but obviously from a land perspective, not very long at all. And we're really finding our way with how we want to relate to this piece of land here. It's been farmed for 25 of those 30 years with an organic free-range chicken farm that my dad's been running. And there's a kind of sense of shift of the kind of purpose of the space, I suppose. It's felt like a transitional time, partly through Dad getting a little bit older and looking for different ways of spending his energy and time now, and his children, me and my brother and my sister, becoming more engaged and connected with this space here. So we are in this transitional phase, and part of my kind of sort of commitment to the space is about the rewilding. I feel really drawn to just making the best of the natural environment that we can for the nature, for supporting the earth. And with that, I'm feeling it's so important to enable other people, other humans, to have connection. I feel there's a great loss of kind of experience of knowing how to plant a tree, wanting to, but maybe not so many opportunities as there used to be. So that feels what I'm really called to at the moment, is to use the space that I have opportunity to have access to enable other people to come and enjoy being in nature, soak up some sun, hear the birds, know how it is and how it feels to plant a few trees, to build a den or whatever the connection is for them. You know, there's opportunity here for much of that, which feeds into the kind of sense of diversity, and yeah, that feels important.
And also in terms of your work as you're an osteopath.
Yeah.
So as a healer in that sense as well, do you feel like this relates also to personal growth and healing as well, being out in nature and experiencing?
Yeah, very much so. I think through my work I've sort of come to really touch and palpate what it feels like to have transitions in life. We all go through developmental stages from, you know, birth, walking, and you know, adolescence, and then even in adulthood. You know, we might think that we turn adults at 21 or whatever the magic number is for you, and then that's it. But, you know, it just isn't true. There are so many transitions as a human. And for me, my feeling is that we are assisted in those processes by understanding nature's cycles. We are nature. There are cycles in seasons, and there are cycles in, you know, the greater sort of natural rhythms of this planet that we're so interconnected with. And I think easing our and deepening our relationship with those cycles enables our own transitions, you know, makes those pathways and journeys. You know, we have to let things go. Nature lets things go all the time, but that can be a difficult thing to navigate as a human in the structures that we tend to box ourselves into. So, yeah, very much so. My hope and dream is to bring more young people out. I feel there's a big need at the moment for young people to be in nature and feel safe on this planet. You know, there's been lots of talk about the changes, and we know that needs to be taken care of, but how do we take care of the planet if we don't feel safe here and know how to work with it? So
So far I know that you've been quite surprised by the response that you've had for the tree planting, and can you tell me more about the projects that have brought you the trees and also this response that you received for doing that as well?
Our family's been connected with and working with a youth organisation called the Woodcraft Folk for actually three generations of my family, but it's been going on for longer than that in the UK. And much of the mission around that is the kind of hope is bringing people outdoors into nature, but also learning to work cooperatively, to spread friendship, to think about peace. And so there's been an opportunity with the farm space we have here to lean into that network and to bring kids out into the countryside for camping. And they've done some tree planting over the past few years. We've done more of that with our youth organisation. So when this opportunity came to work with the organisation where I get the trees from is also a voluntary organisation called the Conservation Volunteers. And they have a mission to get 1 million trees in the ground, and they're really leaning into and reaching out and connecting up to other small grassroots initiatives, you know, like ours and schools and other community groups, to get this 1 million trees that they've seeded to saplings they've grown, to get them all in the ground. So I wanted to take 200 from them this year, but because of COVID, actually, we haven't been able to have the Woodcraft all meet together the way that we've done it before. So I needed to find another network or another way of reaching out and asking for people to help us get these 200 trees in the ground. So it gave me the nudge to ask for help into some of the other groups that I'm connected to. And yeah, I'm really surprised how many people who I've never spoken to, I've just shared a kind of WhatsApp group with a few other people, and suddenly the word just seemed to be out there. And so we've had people from 5 different networks and community groups all coming up to the farm at different times and working in their own family groups and bubbles, so that we've kept people, you know, COVID safe as much as we can, to all work together in one sort of shared project. So it's been really, really nourishing for me to receive that generosity of energy, and really I feel excited and hopeful about what we can all do if we work together, and how we interact between all the different groups of like-minded.
Completely. And it's been quite a grassroots project because it's spread so organically. Like I'm here through the word of mouth, and I know that that's been the way for a lot of families coming. And yeah, it really feels like a very positive feeling here today, just watching people come with their families. And in terms of the rewilding project that you're doing at the moment, are you feeling like there's been a kind of resistance in the community, or are you challenged by anything? Or for anyone who is in a similar situation to you, who has land and they're trying to work out how to use it more in a more sustainable and environmentally friendly way, what has been your biggest challenges, and what kind of advice would you give to people who are also in a similar place?
Yeah, I think trying to engage in our local community has been sometimes quite challenging. There are some, you know, there are some stuck mindsets out there, Although there is a kind of global interest in taking care of our planet, I'm afraid I often have the feeling that people want sustainability projects to happen somewhere else. You know, somehow that isn't quite as beautiful enough for their little patch of countryside. And I guess that has been a real challenge and a sticking point to... But, you know, where there is challenge, there is also the potential for much to be learnt and to grow. And I think it's required I've had to dig deep to find ways to communicate and build up a relationship with people who don't have the same view set, you know, mindset that I do, that we do on this particular plot of land, so that we can enable this kind of shift to happen. But it needs to happen within a time frame that feels manageable in the community environment that we are set in. That is, we need to bring these people with us and make that feel safe and manageable as we all transition a more sustainable way of living, because it does need to happen in local areas. It does need to happen in the southeast as much as it happens anywhere else. We can't just outsource this to other countries and other counties and other parts of the world. You know, we've got to be doing it in our areas, and that requires change. You know, it does change the landscape. It changes what we see in our fields. You know, solar panels don't necessarily look that attractive, but you know, there's a challenge around that. But some things have to be allowed for progress and you know, development around sustainability and ways of doing things to move on. So I would say that's been quite challenging. I think the thing that's been most helpful and nourishing and rewarding and encouraging is actually just really leaning into the networks that were already established, you know, that I had already been doing some of this work in a grassroots kind of way for 10-15 years. I've been working with the Woodcraft folk and with other volunteer organizations and local networks of women's groups and circles of friends who all have the similar mindset. So really leaning into the strength of those mixed communities and feeling, you know, that I can be supported by that enables me to do my bit, you know. And
it's so nourishing as well to hear that and to be here and be part of it, and also just be putting my hands in the ground and smelling the earth. Such a pleasure.
It's pretty magic, isn't
it? So thank you for having us here, and
thank you for coming and sharing your energy and time. It's really greatly appreciated.
And now I would like to take you over to Cyprus with me on part of my journey, where our course leader Martin explains why shepherding has an important part to play within the ecosystem. And when sheep or goats are shepherded, they are actually more useful for the environment rather than harmful. So I'd just like to invite you over to the mountains of Cyprus with me, where Martin explains what we're seeing as we look over at an old shepherd's house in the mountains.
Now, the reason for stopping here was that I thought we might see the shepherd. So the shepherd, this is the shepherd's overnight place. And over a two-day cycle, they take the sheep and the goats, especially goats, actually, up through the forest. So they graze down here. They milk them here. They carry on maybe the next day up the valley. They go all the way to Vabatsinya. Maybe 15 kilometres. They milk them there and then they come back down. And it's a cycle. It's transhumance.
Yeah.
Everybody used to do it, but now very few people do it. The British tried to ban the goats from the forest.
Why?
Typical stupid bureaucratic.
Why?
Because they said they caused damage, but the shepherds don't allow the sheep and goats to cause damage. It's not in their interest.
Of course.
Shepherds are sustainable managers of land.
So
they
really
keep them moving. And if you keep them moving, they actually improve the vegetation.
Because I've heard the opposite, that they actually destroy the land because they take the tree saps before they even establish
if
themselves.
They're not shepherded.
Exactly. If you just let them be
destroy. And actually, it's interesting, if you have sheep and goats together, they don't mix too much.
Uh-huh.
and the sheep are very passive and obedient. So they go in a line, and occasionally they glance at the shepherd because they absolutely love the shepherd.
Whereas the goats are like,
and the goats are going.
The goats are. He's looking away. He's looking away. Look.
Let's see that.
No. Let's
get those roses from somebody's garden. So goats and sheep are completely different.
Now they say that goats, because they have a much greater variety of food, have a better intelligence. They have a different sort of brain.
Why is it called transhuman?
Transhumans. It's humans. Moving of animals and people. In connection with each other. Spain and Portugal were very famous for it.
Transhumancia, we
say. Transhumancia, we say
in
Spanish.
It's a super... Now they are saying it needs to come back to some extent, and they research it a lot, and they say how much good effect it actually does. And
we still have transhumans in Colombia.
Yes.
To 3,000 kilometers looking for water in the dry season.
This is great.
Is there some relationship between transhumans and pilgrimage? This kind of...
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
There must be, surely. Yeah.
Some of those pilgrim routes in Spain and the Pyrenees, and they were also shepherd routes.
Martin, these transhumans that happened here in Cyprus, they were for several days, the one you were talking about.
3 or 4 days total, maximum. In the summer... It's shorter because there's less to eat. But in the spring, it's maybe a day longer because there's an abundance. There's so much halloumi eaten here that there's not enough milk.
We'll make some halloumi.
So they buy milk from Bulgaria and Romania.
Thank you so much for those of you who have joined my show today, from the UK to the boreal forests of Russia and then over to Cyprus. So it's been quite an all-out show today, and if you have any comments or feedback, please don't hesitate to contact us through the UK Health Radio website. If you want to explore more of my stories and my journalism, you can check me out through earthwitness.news. And you can follow me on Instagram at Yasmin Anta. So I hope you enjoyed today's show, and this might have maybe inspired you or made you see land management from a few different perspectives there. And what I find really interesting about being here in Cyprus is that we're learning about very old and ancient forms of land management where humans are able to cooperate with the land in order to nurture it and also to sustain themselves and benefit from it. As I was saying at the beginning of the show, so many of the olive groves have been abandoned, and in turn the ancient olives are threatened. So there's definitely a co-relationship humans can have with nature when it's not, as Adre said, just about the economic aspect of land management. And even within conservationism, when you hear about when people are taken away from their land in the name of conservation, it's as if they don't understand what conservation is, in my opinion. So that's my thank you again for listening and for being here. Please like, share and follow us on Instagram as well. We now have an environment and conservation show on Instagram. Yeah, please feel free to keep up to date with all of our shows, and goodbye for now.